Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. What's scarier than a murderer? Someone with the charisma to compel others to kill for them, or to kill themselves. Meet these cult leaders and get an inside look at their beliefs and how they controlled others. Some cults, led by leaders like Charlie Manson, Jim Jones, and David Koresh, are notorious, but others are less well known, such as Shoko Asahara and his doomsday cult Aum Shinrikyo, who orchestrated the sarin gas attack on the Tokyo subway, or Joseph DiMambro and Luke Jouret, who founded the Order of the Solar Temple, a doomsday cult that led to the death of 51 members by murder or suicide. Then there is Marshall Applewhite, leader of Heaven's Gate, who along with 38 followers killed themselves in the belief that the Hale-Bopp comet signaled the arrival of a spaceship that would transport them to a higher plane of existence. What makes cult leaders so compelling is their often unfathomable power over their adherents. Why do people kill others or themselves for a questionable set of beliefs? Killer Cults tells the stories behind both famous and unfamiliar cults and the people behind them. Across a series of profiles, we learn the jaw-dropping truth behind some of the most mystifying and deadly cults and their leaders, all of whom led their followers down a dark path. The book that we're featuring this evening is Killer Cults, Stories of Charisma, Deceit, and Death, with my special guest journalists and authors, Joyce and Stephen Singular. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview.
Hi, Joyce, thanks for having
Singular.
Us back.
Thank you so much. It's it's always a great pleasure to have you both on, talking about this latest book, Killer Cults. Let's just talk about what is contained in this, the stories that we mentioned that both familiar and not so familiar. Can you tell us what some of the chapters are in this book, 19 of them in all?
Right. Well, we start with Keith Raniere, who's become quite well-known and notorious with his Nexium cult that has had emerged in the last decade and had gone. He'd gone to trial in New York and been convicted and received a lengthy sentence. That story brought in several celebrities. There were, one was a Allison Mack, who was a TV actress, and then there was an heir to the Seagrams' fortune, Sarah Bronfman. So that we lead off with that. We go to an obscure cult called the Sullivanians. I particularly thought this was very fascinating because mm-hmm. there's a tendency to believe that maybe cults only draw in uneducated people, people who aren't worldly, people who don't have many resources. But this was a cult founded on the Upper West Side of Manhattan in the 70s, and it was filled with very intelligent, very worldly people, people with resources who were drawn into the idea, basically the fundamental idea is how do we make better human beings, basically through psychoanalysis. There was
in that particular cult, even Judy Collins, the singer,
right.
was a member for a while. So that's what we found fascinating about. And we had them we asked the publishing house to specifically put the Sullivanians right next to the next cult that we profiled, of Magdalena Solis, a woman cult leader in Mexico, because, as Steve mm-hmm. said, we found it fascinating from a psychological point of view, that very well-educated people with resources from all socioeconomic groups would join cults and to be totally on the opposite side, like in Magdalena Solis and Yerba Buena, Mexico in the 60s, these people were very insular, isolated, in a little mountain town in Mexico, uneducated, very, very poor. So we found, you know, that across the board, people from all walks of life have been pulled into cults throughout the history of the human race, apparently.
Right, and it's always what hits the deepest emotional needs. And a number of the ones that we'll be talking about, there's this idea of improving the human race. That's one of the themes that runs through a lot of it, how to make people right. better, how to deal with issues like racism or poverty and things like that. So in numerous cases, they start out with high ideals, and they certainly don't end that way. The next one is Bhagwan Rajneesh, fascinating story that unfolded in the 70s and 80s in Oregon. Rajneesh was a spiritual leader, guru in India, and he ran into some trouble there and decided to come to the American West and bring his flock with him and start over. And again, it appeared that, you know, they had good motives, at least at one time, but he sort of descended into somebody who wanted to have 100 Rolls Royce, a $1 million watch, all kinds of things, as he sent out his minions to do some really nefarious things, like trying to take over some towns through voting rolls by poisoning some of the local population so those people wouldn't be around to vote.
And that particular story was very well documented in a Netflix documentary called Wild, Wild Country, which I would highly recommend, just to see the depths to which these people went to control their group and then others around them, and to control the voting bloc in the towns that they started occupying.
And again, it was basically a woman who was running this, my name, Ma Sheila. Rajneesh sort of backed off and just lived this life of splendor or took a vow of silence. But there were several very powerful women who basically took over this cult and did a lot of the activities that we're talking about. The next one was Joseph DeMombro and Luc Jouret. As you mentioned, Dan, they decided to recreate the solar temple in modern times. And again, it started out with sort of New Age ideas and maybe New Age ideals.
Well, it actually, I thought, started out with some occult types of stories, like based on Rosicrucians and the Knights Templar. That's another aspect we found very, you know, compelling about writing about all these different types of cults, was that it spanned from, you know, offshoots of Christianity to satanic cults and New Age cults and occult cults, you know, and it just, there was just no, you know, set group that it seemed to prey upon. It infiltrates into all aspects of religious belief.
Right,
right.
The next one is one people have heard about, Jim Jones, the People's Temple. Again, what I found fascinating about Jones is that he started out in the Midwest, I believe in Indiana, and he was very committed to civil rights, to racial equality, to you know, really some social ideals, and he wanted to do good in the world. He eventually moved to California and started recruiting members to his People's Temple. And the strain that you sort of find here is that once people start to accumulate power, it often has a very corrosive and debilitating effect. And with him, that's certainly true.
And I've also found that, you know, even though we profiled some of these very well-known cults like Jim Jones and the People's Temple and Charles Manson and the Branch Davidians, I found in doing the research that we uncovered details that I had never really gone deeply into. I mean, you know, when you heard the accounts of these crimes being committed at the time, I think most people just saw what was on television or they heard on the media. But as we looked closer, it was interesting to find, and we've always been interested in where religion intersects with violence. I mean, three of the books that we've worked on have been primarily that, the BTK serial killer, the Dr. Tiller assassination, Jennifer Reale, a woman in Colorado Springs that was coerced by her lover to kill his wife based on, you know, that she would be forgiven and redeemed if she just embraced Christianity. we've always found that particular, oh, and the Alan Berg book, right?
Yeah,
that one too. So we've always found that an interesting area to explore. And with the Jim Jones People Temple, an interesting fact on that one was that the congressman that was murdered in on the airstrip in Guyana, when they went down to investigate based on the people in his district telling him that their relatives were complaining about the living conditions down there. Can you remember his name, Steve?
No, not at the
moment. We always forget that. Well, the interesting thing about that was that his aide was Jackie Speer, who was shot multiple times, and now she is a congresswoman from California. And she has spoken publicly about, you know, what that was like to be on that airstrip when they were attacked and ambushed by the followers of Jim Jones.
Right.
Oh, Leo Ryan. That was the name, sorry.
Yeah. And again, it just shows the power that Jones had over these people. One of the things that struck me, which I didn't know before writing this, was that he had, I think, three times previous to the actual mass suicide that occurred in 1978, he had asked his followers, which were about 1,000 down there, to drink something, you know, drink a concoction, which he said was poison, just to see if they would actually drink the thing. And it wasn't poison, but every time he asked, they actually went ahead and drank it. So he had a pretty good idea that, you know, that when the time came to actually conduct a mass suicide, they would do that. So again, a lot of these people held high ideals. A lot of them were educated, but they had this, you know, profound weakness and this desire to follow a leader who was going to give them absolute answers.
And in many cases, a charismatic leader.
Yeah. He was an interesting looking man. You know, he had the swoop of dark
and well spoken, spoke like a preacher.
Yeah.
You know, had that ability to draw people in. We also found that as a parallel with some of the serial killers that we've written about, like John Robinson, the man who entombed his victims in 55-gallon drum barrels outside of Kansas City. They just had an ability to be a real fast talker, think fast on their feet, to know how to charm people, to disarm people.
Yeah, if I were naming a quality of a cult leader or trying to identify one in particular, it's somebody who can get people who have never engaged in criminal behavior, people who would shun criminal behavior in most circumstances, to commit crimes at their behest. I mean, they have that ability to, in case after case, they don't actually commit the crimes, but they get seemingly, you know, normal people to do that through their will.
And they also get people to turn over their financial resources and to disassociate themselves with their family, their core unit, family unit. That seems to be one of the driving principles with a lot of these cult leaders that we discovered.
And they also tried basically to take over their sex lives or their sexuality in certain cases by determining who can sleep with whom, who can marry whom, you know, who should have sex and at what time and in what circumstances. So, I mean, they go for the most, you know, intimate and vulnerable parts of people, their resources, their family, their sexuality.
But then continuing down the list, then the next person on the list was James Arthur Ray, who was a self-help guru, and he was featured in the book The Secret, which became, you know, a huge bestseller worldwide.
Right.
And an interesting thing about him was that, you know, he was touted on both the Ellen DeGeneres Show and Oprah Winfrey, of course, that they didn't know at the time, that, you know, what he was doing would lead to three people's deaths outside of Sedona, Arizona, in a kind of a Native American sweat lodge ceremony.
Yeah.
So he brought people there. It cost a lot of money to go. He had some prior problems with trying to put people in extreme circumstances to see if they could endure them, apparently as a way of building their character or their endurance. And he had these people go into a tent in Arizona in very hot, at a very hot time. The space inside the tent got up to 122 degrees. People were gasping for air, begging to get out. And he, you know, essentially said they needed to go in. He was convicted, not on murder, but on lesser charges, and served a
couple of years,
prison
I think
time.
It was. Yeah, but the thing is, and then he got out, and now he's trying to reinvent himself again.
Right, but again, these people were not unsophisticated at all. You know, they were just willing to do whatever he said, you know, right up to the point of costing them their lives. So
one of the common threads, though, is, as well as is offering these people this incredible advantage with whatever the philosophy of the cult is as well. When you mentioned James Arthur Ray, I just have to mention as well that he had the endorsement of people like Oprah Winfrey. And so it seems that one of the common threads is that it's easier to attract a celebrity, and then a lot of that recruiting is done because of the celebrity itself.
That's definitely true in this case. You know, he was charismatic. He was good looking. He was successful. He had the backing of those celebrities. And again, people, I mean, if there's any, you know, lesson here that runs through so many of them, I mean, at some point you have to listen to yourself. You know, you can't give away your personal power to somebody who's charismatic. Once they cross that line into very questionable or even criminal behavior. And he, you know, again, he had something of a track record of putting people in dangerous circumstances and, you know, ending up in a tragic situation. So, yeah, I mean, you have to pick your guru very carefully.
And then the next man on the list is a man from Japan named Shoko Asahara. He grew up in Japan in a small village, started out selling Chinese medicine, but he was eventually arrested for peddling fake drugs. Then he traveled to Tibet and Nepal, where he claimed that he achieved enlightenment by studying Buddhism and Hinduism. He went back to Japan, and he formed a group called the Aum Shinriko, and hopefully I'm not mangling that name, but where he combined Eastern philosophy with apocalyptic teachings. And this is another thread that we've found through many of these cults, this apocalyptic end of times, using that tactic to scare people and to say, you know, this is when we're going to ascend into heaven, or this is when the rapture is going to occur, or this is when the great earthquake in California is going to occur. And that was part of the driving force as we were leading up to the year 2000 and to 2012, when the Mayan prophecy and when the Mayan calendar supposedly ended. A lot of groups were built up on that foundation and that fear.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, especially the end of the millennium. That's a theme that runs through much of this.
Yeah, and with that Shoko Asahara, he is the one that his followers unleashed sarin nerve gas in the subway in Tokyo. And it was, what I found interesting about him was that he had recruited, again, very educated chemists and engineers and journalists and, I mean, people in the legal system, telecommunications, people that joined that group had worked for IBM in Japan, Toshiba, Hitachi, other major companies. They gave thousands and thousands of dollars to his organization.
Yeah. Yeah. And his plan in putting the nerve gas in there was to kill thousands of people. It didn't turn out that way. It was a much, much smaller figure. But the plan was for absolute mass destruction. And it was probably the biggest, well, it was the biggest sort of potential mass destruction event in Japan since the end of World War II, and people were very, very shaken by it.
Yeah,
but,
and besides, you know, sexual manipulation, he subjected his followers to sleep and food deprivation, sensory deprivation, hallucinogens to induce visions. We saw that in other sects and cults, exerting mind control. Sometimes people were allowed to leave the sect, but only after they had agreed to turn over their property to him. And the some that refused disappeared or died. No.
Yeah. Yeah, so he and a handful of his followers, I think about six or seven, were eventually executed. It took a long time to go through the Japanese legal system, but The trial lasted eight years.
Yeah.
And he pretended or actually was insane at that point.
Yeah.
Just talked a lot of gibberish in the courtroom.
I think
or
they
elsewhere.
Executed him by hanging
in
July of 2018.
Yeah, they hung all of them. So that it wasn't legally resolved until very recently. So.
To at the same time, it's interesting that at one time Japanese government considered this sect a religion. So it's interesting to go from legitimacy to outright, you know, being executed is interesting,
yeah,
to say the least.
But and also interesting, well, maybe, you know, maybe pretty understandable that absolute power, you know, it just pollutes absolutely. When somebody is given that much control and that many resources, they start to get corrupted, especially if they had any bit of sociopathic or narcissistic psychopathic tendencies to begin with.
But again, you think about sending people out to poison their fellow citizens and people, you know, being willing to do that, just to follow the orders and go and, you know, create the circumstances that could have been far worse than they were.
Absolutely.
Amazing to me that, you know, his net worth jumped to like $4.3 million to $1 billion 6 years later. He had people throughout the world, Russia, New York, you know, all over Japan. It's incredible that he had that many followers at one time.
Right. And the people, I mean, there's just been this hunger running through all of these stories of people to find somebody who can give them absolute answers to what really are life's mysteries. I mean, if that's the hook also, I don't have to think for myself. I don't have to solve these problems. In many cases, I don't have to earn a living and make money.
Maybe their family life wasn't that great, so they want to join up with a better family, a larger purpose.
Right. We interviewed someone who was in the Reverend Moon organization, and he didn't participate in any criminal behavior or anything, but that's basically what he said. You know, he was looking for a family, and this at that time was the best alternative for him until Reverend Moon decided to pick who he would marry, and that was sort of the thing that pushed him out.
I really like his quote. He was in there for 12 years, and he said, "I felt myself at loose ends. I had a deep longing for connection, for overriding spirituality. I gave myself completely to this extended nuclear family. We wanted to make a better world. If I trusted in God and gave myself completely to it, what could go wrong?" I just thought that was really a pivotal quote to put at the very beginning of the book.
Yeah, definitely. It's a mindset that runs through much of this. The next cult was in Massachusetts, Fall River, just called the Fall River Cult. I thought it was really, really interesting. It's one of the shorter entries in the book, but it was basically just this group of criminals, sort of the underbelly of Fall River,
pimps and prostitutes.
Right, who got into called a satanic cult and created what was locally known as the Satanic Panic, where people were disappearing and being mutilated out in the woods and things like that. But it's, you know, we researched the story, wrote the story. When you get to the end of it, I, for one, didn't know exactly what happened because they were all blaming each other for doing this.
And some of them rescinded their original statements, but I believe they are making a movie of that one. Or have made it, and I believe it might be called Satanic Panic, actually.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of criminal, I mean, again, these people were involved in criminal behavior, and it's one of the most colorful and compelling and interesting of the entries in the anthology.
And then the next one is, of course, Charles Manson, which everybody's heard so much about. So what I found interesting on that were some of these little details where we really had to dive deep. And I didn't realize, I mean, I must have been about seventh grade when that crime occurred. And it was sort of the end of the, you know, the free love hippie, the benevolent type of hippie movement. That crime seemed to kind of stop all that, and that this darker side emerged. But I didn't remember, and I had read, you know, Victor Bugliosi's seminal book on it, Helter Skelter, years ago. And but I didn't realize that the group had not only targeted, you know, who they thought was Terry Melker, Doris Day's son, who lived in the house that Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski had rented, but they had also had on their death list of celebrities people like Richard Burton, Steve McQueen, Tom Jones, Elizabeth Taylor, Frank Sinatra. And those little details that where we really had to dive deep into the story, I found fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, the demonic nature of Charles Manson, I think, really comes through in this piece. And, I mean, he was somebody who was sort of fits the standard profile of the psychopath, you know, damaged at a very early age, sort of cast aside in many ways.
And institutionalized.
Goes in and out of prison very, very often. And he sort of, you know, he sort of comes out. There are a number of stories in this anthology that dovetail kind of with the 1960s and all of that. He wanted to, you know, write songs and get in the music business and sort of ride the wave of all of those things. And, you know, he tried to do that, but he kept getting rebuffed in that world as well. He wasn't that talented. And, you know, he just descends further and further into criminal madness.
And again, preyed on young, people that were on the street, that were doing drugs, that were disenfranchised. Those were his targets, you know, and that's where a lot of, not all of these cult members, but a lot of them, that's who they would prey on, people like that, that they could tell were looking for something or needed something larger to belong to.
Right. Right. The next one is a fairly unwell-known one, Adolfo Constanzo, who grew up in Florida, I believe
in
Miami,
and
where the drug trade there was becoming very, very intense.
It was during the time of, what's that famous
Pablo
narco?
Escobar.
Yes.
He sort of studied Pablo Escobar's reign of terror in Colombia. It's estimated that Escobar may have been responsible for about 5,000 deaths. And this guy sort of studied that, looked at it. He also, with his mother, I believe, had gotten into Santeria, which is a form of religion. And
kind of like voodoo.
Yeah, kind of like voodoo. And so he eventually gravitated into the drug world himself, recruited people.
But he partnered up with this young woman named Sara Aldrete. And she's interesting because she was a model student. She was, you know, successful, and she became president of her soccer booster club, and she'd received the National Collegiate Health Physical Award. But she also had this fascination with the dark arts and black magic. And that came up when she took up with this Constanzo. And then she devoted herself to his cause. So, again, this is another interesting aspect of studying these cults. In some instances, it takes two people to form this other entity that will actually carry out these types of crimes, whereas maybe one or the other alone would not have ever done that. But the two together form a different entity where they can feed off each other, and sort of like Klebold and Harris did.
Klebold and Harris and Dick Hickok and Perry Smith and then Cold Blood.
Mm-hmm.
You thought Dick Hickok was the really bad guy with the criminal, you know, mind and the plans, but Perry ends up being the killer, you know, bad chemistry.
Yeah.
In the Adolfo Constanzo case, I mean, one of the things I found interesting was that they had property in Mexico where they were doing a lot of drug deals and other criminal activities, and they were killing people and chopping them up and burying them and all of that. But one night, a young American man was there and crossed the border from Texas into Mexico looking for some sort of action probably, and ends up dead. And it was that killing of the American that set off the investigation. I mean, something you find, you know, in other stories as well. When you kill an American citizen or somebody in the government, DEA, FBI, any of that, it ups the ante for an investigation by a lot. And that sort of unleashed the authorities on Alfonso and on Sara Aldrete, and that's what brought them down. So
he was later killed, or he killed himself, or had someone kill him, but she was sentenced to 30 years in jail.
Right. She tried to sort of wiggle out of her responsibility in the case, but it didn't work. So it's, again, it's a fascinating tale that most people don't know that much about.
Yeah, the ones in Mexico, like Magdalena Solis and this one, I found fascinating.
I did too.
Me too, yeah.
I thought they were, were very interesting. The next one is something, again, people have probably heard of, Marshall Applewhite and Heaven's Gate in 1997. Again, they thought that they were, their purpose was to really ascend to a higher plane of existence from what we have on Earth. And they had talked about this and planned this for a long, long time. And they took as a sign that when the Hale-Bopp comet passed by the Earth, and I believe in the spring of 97, there would be a spaceship behind it, and that spaceship would whisk them away into this other dimension. So again, these were not unsophisticated people at all. They were very much ahead of the curve in terms of computer technology and the early work on the internet. And they were in the mid-90s. They were putting out information about their belief system and what they thought was going to happen, and recruiting people to their cause and bringing in money and all of those things. They moved to the very wealthy suburb in Southern California of Rancho de Santa Fe. And then, you know, in April of 97, they laid their final plans.
The onset of the internet has been an interesting factor also in some of these cults, because the ability to recruit grew exponentially once they were able to go online and reach vast, vast numbers of possible recruitees.
Right.
Absolutely.
So they finally decided, again, in April 97, to have their last meal at Marie Callender's restaurant. They all ate the same thing, I think.
Yeah, and then they all dressed in the same clothing.
They all dressed in the same clothing. They put, like, $5 in their pockets.
$5.35 or something.
Right, so that they could have transit fare to the next place they were going, and they took a concoction. And you know, when somebody came by the house, and of course the smell had gotten very bad. I believe there were 39 bodies laid out in their dark clothing, with their tennis shoes on and their veils over their faces. And it was a shocking story. I believe that President Clinton even talked about it at a national level.
Yeah, he did.
So again, it tied into the new millennium coming, only 3 years away. The apocalypse was at hand. You know, there's a better existence out there somewhere, and if you just follow me and take your life, we'll find it. Extraordinary message that people would be willing to follow.
Right. Let's just pause for a second for these messages. Now, Joyce and Stephen, you were talking about Marshall Applewhite and Heaven's Gate, and talking about also, it's incredible the things that people will do. We talked about the Adolfo Constanzo and the human sacrifice cult, and what those people were capable of doing, ripping out hearts and other organs and dismemberment. And then the Marshall Applewhite, he had castrated himself and then convinced members, other members, that they should castrate themselves as well.
Yeah,
let's talk about
bring that up, because Steve and I were discussing that yesterday, and I said, you know, in the research, we couldn't find presumably he went to a medical facility to have that done. I don't know how one could do that to oneself. Because he was unable to stifle his sexual urges.
Well, he was also deeply conflicted about being gay or not gay, and he married this woman, as Joyce alluded to earlier. She sort of, the two of them together, you know, began to lay these, you know, great plans about their transit into the next realm. But again, it sort of took the combination of people to get it off the ground.
Right.
So.
And also in all these cases too, there's a combination of things where there's a confluence of events, and sort of, like you say, that it's the turn of the millennium, or the Hale-Bopp comet, or just an unrest in society in the late 60s that is part of the allure, or feeds into the allure anyway.
Right, and you know, if you think about some of those decades, I mean, one of the things that, you know, they were known for is somewhat the disintegration of the nuclear family. I mean, people were getting a lot more divorces. Kids were growing up with maybe much more without two parents. I mean, all of that slow unraveling of the fabric was going on. You have kids who, you know, are maybe at loose ends and looking for something. I mean, there are examples here where, you know, people start coffee houses with a religious undertone, start drawing them in, again, through the music of the 60s and things like that. And you know, I was around a situation like that myself once, and I could see how vulnerable people were and how much they were looking to a leader.
You mean about that minister in your small town
right.
that was
but he then
luring
went,
in young men?
He
yeah.
was then, but then he went to a much more populated area in New Jersey, just outside of New York City, and you kind of thought, well, these people are more sophisticated. But they weren't. You know, they were looking for someone to basically show them the way. And again, it may be redundant, but to me, it's just one of these themes of not sort of being willing to take responsibility for your life, figure out who you are, find your own answers, take your own steps, being willing to sort of do that for yourself. It's the absolute common theme of all of this. If you just hand over that personal power, you know, your life will get better. It's a very dubious thought.
And it's a very, it was, you know, for us writing the book was, not only did we educate ourselves vastly on a lot of these details that we neither one of us remembered or knew
right.
about, but we just think it's really a good thing to put out there for people to read about so they can see how vulnerable people can be preyed upon and how quickly it can descend into something horrendous and
right.
out of control and spiral totally out of control, and putting your trust into someone you know, just blindly like that.
And all three of us are, you know, very familiar with researching and writing about criminal behavior, you know, in a cult, and this runs through most of this. You know, you can believe anything you want up to a certain point, you can do anything you want, but when you cross that line into criminal behavior, you know, whatever that is, it not only changes the dynamic of the cult, but it brings in law enforcement. And that's, I mean, in the Rajneesh case, it was really true. For example, they would go into these tiny towns in Oregon, and they would make a point of having sex on the lawns of these people. Not necessarily a crime, but when you start poisoning their food and people start getting sick and could potentially die, and you cross that line into criminal behavior, that's what brings the rain down on you.
And some of the frustrating things for me, anyway, reading about these people is that some of these people died natural deaths. Sheila, the one involved with the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh group in Oregon, she's living in Switzerland right now. She did do a little bit of time here in the States, but not very long. And David Berg, who we'll talk about a little bit later, he also died at 92 of natural causes. And you just are, it's frustrating to see that some of them actually get away with this.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And some will be prison for a long time, which is reassuring. So
I've got to say, though, that this Chris Korda and the Church of Euthanasia is one of the wackiest stories I've ever, the wackiest things I've ever read. So tell us a little bit about this. Oh, they've just dropped for a second. Yes, tell us about the Chris Korda and the Church of Euthanasia. Like I said, a very, very wacky story.
That's a very interesting one. He's still alive today as well. He was born a man in 1962 in New York and would later transform into a transgender software developer / musician / DJ with a deep attachment to the Dadaist movement, you know, that had started in Europe in 1914 after the start of World War I. He also is like a multimedia artist, electronica music, conceptual art, but started a church called the Church of Euthanasia. And when he was 10, he had read an article in the New York Times about climate change that deeply impacted him. He interpreted it to mean that global warming was irreversible and that the human race was doomed unless some sort of radical action was taken immediately. So when in 20 years later, when he formed this Church of Euthanasia, it promoted mass suicide.
Right. Their slogan was "Save the planet, kill yourself."
Yeah.
So he went to the great extreme of thinking that the human population needed to be lowered significantly in order for the species to have a chance to survive and the planet, you know, to be healthy as well. So some of it seemed like sort of like theater of the absurd. I mean, the Dadaists were known for sort of embracing absurdism in the early 20th century. And some of it was, you know, absurdist theater. But I think the message behind it was quite serious. So he attracted a certain following. I mean, they would go, they were, you know, big supporters of abortion, so which would, you know, be a way, again, of lowering the population. And, you know, attended a number of events like that and did some absurd theatrics around all of that.
But the church was eventually sued by the parents of children who were considering suicide. And then
right.
this Missouri woman was found yeah. dead with a printout from the church lying yeah. next to her. So then a prosecutor in St. Louis, Missouri, threatened the church with voluntary manslaughter charges, and he took down those instructions off of his website.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, it's a very bizarre story. It wasn't known to me before we started this.
Or me.
I wasn't yeah. aware of it. So I think people would find it, you know, very entertaining just to find out the extremes to which this individual went to make a point.
And I thought this was interesting about him. The idea for the Church of Euthanasia came to him in a dream. This is according to his website, where he was confronted by some alien intelligence known as the Bean, who spoke for the inhabitants of the Earth in other dimensions. I mean, you know, you can't make this stuff up.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah, so that was I thought.
And he's still alive and well, living in Europe, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
He still has a Facebook page up.
Right. Mm-hmm. And again, just to tell listeners, I mean, again, this is an anthology. It's not necessarily something which someone would read beginning to end, but you can just dip in and find these very fascinating stories that are, you know, they're 4,000 to 5,000 word entries, and they're easy to, you know, to consume. So it's a different type of project than we've ever worked
yeah.
on before. It's
and
not a long narrative story.
You're right. We purposely interspersed the longer stories about, say, like Manson with the shorter ones, just so that it would be easier to read.
Right. The next one again is a well-known one, the David Koresh Branch Davidian group. In the early 1990s, they had gotten together on this ranch. The ranch had been there. The Branch Davidians had been around for some period of time. David Koresh showed up. Again, he was charismatic. He had natural leadership abilities.
Played guitar, kind of a rock star look about him.
Music runs through this. Developed a following and, you know, had their own lives there on the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas. This is a complicated story, and you know, the ultimate truth of it is something people have to decide for themselves. But the federal government showed up there, and I believe it was in February of 1993, and they were looking into illegal arms on the Branch Davidian ranch.
Well, the ATF thought that they had sold weapons at
yep.
gun shows and
yep.
converted semi-automatic firearms
right.
to automatic without proper permits, which was one of the reasons for going to the compound in the first place.
Right.
So it was an ATF issue originally. Yeah.
Yes, it was ATF, and there were four agents that were initially killed, something many people don't know about, in gunfire. And then the standoff started. It would go from February to April 19th. On March 12th, a new attorney general came into the United States, Janet Reno, and she was, you know, we don't know exactly how well informed she was, but from March 12th to April 20, 29th, April 19th, the negotiations went back and forth, and the authorities were constantly trying to get Koresh to, you know, stop the standoff, let the children go, whatever they could negotiate with them.
And, you know, I thought one of the interesting, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Steve, but one of the interesting aspects of that during the 51-day standoff that I had never heard before until I had to do this deep dive into the research was that the agents had put up spotlights around the property with giant speakers that broadcast around the clock different things like Tibetan monks chanting, telephones ringing, Christmas carols, the sound of rabbits being killed, Nancy Sinatra singing "These Boots Are Made for Walking," reveille.
That would torture
all of,
you.
Yeah, all of it making it harder and harder for the followers of Koresh to get any sleep. That was an interesting tactic I had never heard about.
Right. So eventually, on that morning of April 19, 1993, the federal government made the decision to shoot gas into the compound and, you know, try to flush these people out. There were, it's included in our story that, you know, there were people in the religious community, I mean, scholars and people with knowledge that said, you know, the government doesn't really understand what Koresh believes and what these people are doing, and you don't have to push it, you know, to this extreme. I mean, they have the right to practice their religion under the First Amendment. And so that argument was made. The government decided to go in. What we think happened is that then Koresh or the followers set fires, and that caused a conflagration that ended up with, I believe, 76 or 77 people dead, including 25 children.
Well, they actually had a report filed by a man named Danworth, whose conclusion was that the Koresh followers had actually started the fires.
Right.
Even though the FBI and Janet Reno later said that it is possible that some of the weapons that they shot in could have ignited something.
Right.
So there
it's
always will be
ambiguous.
That's where you have to make up your own mind, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, and Janet Reno and Bill Clinton both said later on they were somewhat of a mea culpa in saying, you know, if we had it to do over, we might do this differently.
Yeah.
So that went on for years. There were congressional investigations and other things, but I mean, obviously, an overwhelming tragedy.
Right.
There. And
with all
and,
the children, all those poor children that got killed. Yeah.
Right.
Horrible.
And in another story that we'll get to later, I mean, this cloud of Waco has hung over a number of other situations where the federal government does not quite know what to do when there's a standoff. Are people armed? Do they have bombs? Are they going to blow up themselves?
Right.
It's a very tough decision.
And the damage to the government's credibility at that point, at least in some people's eyes, had already been done.
Well,
because now there's reports of a growing militia movement spreading across the country, in part because of what happened at Waco.
And 2 years later to the day, Timothy McVeigh went to Oklahoma City with his truck full of explosives, very much making the point that it was the same day, just 2 years later, and blowing up the Alfred Murrah building in Oklahoma City and killing 168 men, women, and children. So the repercussions of this have rolled out. I mean, Koresh has been seen as sort of a religious or right-wing martyr ever since.
Well, and because Timothy McVeigh had studied this white supremacist novel, The Turner Diaries, which is about it's a fictional account of a revolutionary named Earl Turner who blows up a federal building, you know,
that's
going to tie into later another.
So there are some cross ties here in some of these stories.
Right.
The next one is, again, it wasn't that well known to me, David Berg and the Children of God. And this one, at least from my point of view, just seems like somebody who is a sex criminal and just decided to get into the business of, you know, salvation and religion and trying to offer people, you know, answers to the impending apocalypse.
Well, he found his little niche there in the counterculture movement in Southern California in 1968. And he gained notoriety for incorporating sexuality into his spiritual message and recruitment methods.
Yeah.
So, you know, what was interesting to me about him was that he hit upon this idea to lure young people who said they were ready for his Christian message. He opens a coffee shop. He brings in rock music. He hands out free peanut butter sandwiches. you know, his timing was good because those activities were coinciding with the hippie movement, and you know, and the music thing really was one of his inroads. Guitars and evangelism were gaining ground at that time, so he capitalized on that, growing communal lifestyle, and he began to dress the part. You know, began to dress so that he looked so that the young people could relate to him.
Right.
Right.
There are big, you know, examples of, as with him, you know, dressing to look like what the image of Jesus we've been given is, you know, whether that's accurate or not, you know, the long hair, the robes and all of that. Now, two very well-known people, Joaquin and River Phoenix, the actors, their parents were drawn into this.
And Rose McGowan.
And Rose McGowan as well.
They were part of that.
They were young. And they were exposed to some of these ideas and activities. River Phoenix, as most people know, an incredibly promising young actor, killed himself in his early 20s, and his brother Joaquin, you know, in interviews has talked about thinking that maybe some of this influence, you know, on him was very bad from a young age. So again, death has attached itself to this group. David Berg was very outspoken about, you know, having sex with everybody at all times. You know, that was his idea of revolution.
But really, really, really disturbing to me, particularly this cult disturbed me the most, because they were having sex with young children and promoting sex with young children, boys and girls, and he would have his followers, some of the young women, he would have them go to bars, and he used this technique called flirty fishing, where they would go to bars and try to get men at the bar to sleep with them and then recruit them into the group or at least take their money so that they could, you know, finance the group. And that was another cult that made just incredible amounts of money.
Yeah.
So that he could sustain this lifestyle. He lived in seclusion apart from his followers who, you know, here he was espousing this humble lifestyle for his followers, but he lives in a nice home with a swimming pool, you know.
Yeah. So he ended up in Europe, I believe Joyce said, away from the legal troubles.
Yeah, exactly. That's how he escaped his legal troubles here in the States and died peacefully at age 92.
The next one in the book is a man named Bob Matthews. I have written about Bob Matthews starting about 35 years ago with the assassination of the talk show host in Denver named Alan Berg, but I thought that Matthews and his group, The Order, were, again, sort of a classic example of a criminal cult. They had studied this book that we referred to earlier called The Turner Diaries, which is about a white power revolution that sweeps across America and gets rid of minorities, gay people, feminist, liberal judges, etc. And Matthews was bold enough to think, let's take this novel and use it as an actual blueprint for real activity. Let's start assassinating people and eliminating minorities. They did commit 240 crimes. They did steal something in the neighborhood of $4.5 million. They did come to Denver and assassinate Alan Berg. Again, he had recruited among the sort of dispossessed, you know, white working class men. Some of them were Vietnam veterans. They were very disaffected. They were very angry, but they had, many of them had never committed or contemplated criminal behavior, and he got them to cross that line into very serious criminal behavior. So he is considered something of a at the end of 1994, he died in a shootout with the FBI at Whidbey Island up near Seattle. And he is considered something of a godfather of the right white nationalist movement that we see today. They refer to his activities, his attempt to bring down the government and the society, and the crimes that he committed. So his thread runs right into the present. If you go onto the far right websites, you'll see that.
Wow.
Yeah. So. The next one is, again, from my perspective, not well-known, Jiang Myon Suk, with a cult named Providence. And again, he was something of a spinoff from the Moon organization.
The Unification Church,
yeah. The Unification Church. And I, in my view, reading about him, he again sort of fell into the category of somebody who was a sex criminal and just sort of used all of these other tools, religion, you know, the impending doom, et cetera, to satisfy himself sexually.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, he was so eventually, as happens in case after case, you know, somebody eventually comes forward and blows the whistle on these people, or civilians do it who are outside the group, as in this case happened, and he is eventually brought down. So the story of Warren Jeffs and the Fundamentalist Latter-day Saints is the next to the last entry in the book. Many people are probably familiar with Warren Jeffs by now, but it's something that we had researched starting in 2006. The book When Men Become Gods about this subject came out in 2008.
And when we went down, we drove down to the compound on the border of Arizona and Utah called Colorado City, where Warren Jeffs and his followers lived. And at the time, Warren Jeffs was on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. And it was rather, it was a little bit nerve-wracking driving around that town, because at that point in time, people didn't know if the FLDS, the Fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, had stockpiled munitions on the edge of town, much like Waco. The authorities were nervous to go in. They didn't know if there was going to be a conflagration or, you know, mass suicide or what was going to happen when we were investigating that particular story.
What struck me about this story, and again, you might think, well, these people were isolated and, you know, uneducated or whatever. I found many of the people who had been thrown out of the FLDS by Warren Jeffs to be quite intelligent, quite well-informed. Before Jeffs, they had all forms of media. They had the Internet. He took over in the early 2000s, so they had all of that technology. But he did things that, to my knowledge, no one else did, and the people that we wrote about, such as he would take men and tell them, you've sinned against the church, or you've sinned against me, so what you need to do is go away and repent for your sins. Go away to St. George, a nearby town, or some other town. Write down all your sins. Stay away until I tell you to come back. While they were gone, he would take, they all had multiple wives. I mean, they might have 20 wives and 40 children. He would take their wives and their children and just disperse them among other men who were in his favor and just give their kids away. I mean, and it was extraordinary to me that these hardworking, you know, decent, bright people would just go along with this until they realized that he was a monstrosity and they...
Well,
they
but I have to make a point here about Warren Jeffs and the FLDS, similar to people that were born into cults, like, say, the Children of God, David Berg.
Right.
Some people are actually born into cults. They don't know anything else until maybe they're old enough to start thinking for themselves, or like as we found in the instances of the Warren Jeffs case, there are always people that are renegades. There are always people that will chafe at the bit and push back about, you know, against authoritarianism. And that's what happened in the Warren Jeffs case. These women stood up against him. And where some of the men failed, these women stood up. They went to court and eventually helped bring him down.
Yes, eventually got the state of Arizona to investigate him. And that led to bringing in the FBI. All of the women that Joyce is referring to had been forced into young marriages, you know, arranged marriages. And finally, they just hit a place where they said, we're going to fight back.
And in many cases, you know, marriage to men that are quite older than them.
Yeah, way
men,
older
men
than
in their
cases.
70s or 80s, you know, and they're like maybe 14 or 16, you know.
Yeah. And Jeffs was eventually picked up when he was on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. He went to trial in Utah in 2007 and was convicted on two rape charges or accomplice to rape. That verdict was overturned, but then the most spectacular part of the story is that he had built this huge white limestone temple in Texas and started moving all of his people there. when the heat got too much in Arizona and Utah. And eventually there was a raid on that compound, and they found that he was marrying, 11-year-olds or 12-year-olds, and right. The evidence was there, and he went to trial in Texas and got what is essentially a life sentence. So he has been brought down and has paid the price.
But there are tendrils of that sect that are still in operation in Canada, in southern Colorado, in other parts of the country. Again, they like to move into places that are isolated, insular, where they can hopefully infiltrate the local politics so they can kind of have some control in that regard.
Yeah, and he has still tried to lead people from his cell in Texas, but his hold is far less than it once was.
And then finally, this is when, the publishing company asked us to do most of those people on the list, and we offered a few suggestions of our own, but we really wanted to end with this Cult of Columbine because we thought this is one that's current, it's ongoing, and this is young people who have supported, the shooters in the Columbine case, Klebold and Harris, saw them as martyrs, and started emulating them and trying to outdo them or trying to, replicate what they did in several schools that they were involved in.
Right. And again, the rise of the Internet, has been, any young person who wants to access, for example, the tapes that Harris and Klebold made leading right up to their crimes, those things are out there. If the authorities had a lot of mixed feelings about releasing some of this material, but ultimately they did, and other people around the country have studied it and taken these guys on as their role models. We provide numerous examples of people who were planning to do some sort of mass killing. In some cases, it didn't come off because I think the authorities have gotten better at detecting these things and stopping them.
Not only the authorities, but people are beginning to see the warning signs and taking it seriously when their classmates or people they know are making statements on social media or exhibiting some kind of strange behavior, and they're actually seeing something and saying something, thankfully.
Right. So, again, it's this idea, are you willing to sacrifice your life for either something or someone that you believe in? And example after example in these cults, people are willing to do that.
It's interesting in these cases, not that they all share the same characteristics, but many of the stories, they share the same kinds of characteristics in terms of how they were lured into these cults and then made to do things like give up your property, give up secrets that to be able to stay in the cult, personal success, peace of mind, supernatural powers, a higher power for the people in the cult. It's incredible all of these similar characteristics to lure some of these same people, same types of people into these groups.
Yes, absolutely. And again, throwing in, the end of the second millennium, the arrival of the new millennium, if we all remember the Y2K scare, that went through the general population. The computer world is going to crash. You have to stockpile food. That was a pretty common idea. And these people just took it to the next two or three levels.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Joyce and Stephen, for coming on and talking about killer cults, stories of charisma, deceit, and death. For those that might want to check this out, is there a Facebook page, a website? Tell us about that.
Our website is www.stephensingular.com, and that's Stephen, StephenSingular.com. We always update that, Dan, so that people can see when things are coming out or when there's going to be television appearances or, podcasts, any developments we always put on the website.
Yep.
Great. Well, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Killer Cults, Stories of Charisma, Deceit, and Death. Thank you very much,
Joyce. Thank you so much for having us, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good night.
Bye.